I said before when I gave this talk as a tech talk for Googlers, I feel a little bit out of place here. I've actually never been an SRE. I'm actually a software engineer, but I like to think that I build tools that make SRE's lives easier. And so that's really what Kubernetes is. It's an effort to try and take some of the things that we've learned internally about running containers at Google and that I've used to great effect to run my software and take it out into the outside world. So if you haven't heard about Kubernetes, it's an open source project to do container management across a cluster of machines, across a fleet of machines. It can run containers in Docker. It can run containers in Rocket recently, CoreOS's container manager. And so that's the basics for Kubernetes. And I wanted to start out with a motivation for why, I guess I have this clicker, I'm supposed to use it. I want to start off with a motivation for why we build this software and why I think it's relevant to the lives of people who build and maintain software. And that this image is the image here that I think captures a lot of this. And the reason that driving a semi-truck, well, there's probably lots of reasons that driving a semi-truck is hard, but the reason that I want to capture here about why driving a semi-truck is hard is the fact that it's a coupled system, right? You put a trailer on a hitch onto another car, it's much harder to do things with that thing. If you have two smaller linear problems, backing up a trailer is much harder than backing up two cars independently. And so if we find coupling in any of our systems across a wide variety of dimensions, they're harder systems to manage. They're harder systems to use reliably. And so I think that if there's a theme to Kubernetes and a theme to what I want to get out there, it's that in all possible places where you can do it, find a way to decouple your systems. And this applies for all sorts of different problems, from scaling software to scaling teams to scaling alerts and everything else like that. The more you can find places to separate things and put a clean contract in between them, the easier it is for you to manage all of those different systems, or in fact have different people manage those different systems. And so I wanted to sort of take a look at what I see as the SRE landscape inside of Google, and I think is the way that we're evolving towards an SRE landscape in general. And that's starting with things like hardware SRE, right, where in many cases, people were talking about how, I'm sorry, I am going to use the word cloud, partially because I'm actually part of the Google Cloud Platform, but where infrastructure as a service, like Compute Engine, Google Compute Engine, or Amazon's EC2, effectively is taking hardware ops and making hardware ops a service, right? You no longer hire those people. You pay Google or Amazon or Microsoft or whoever your cloud provider is to hire those people, and they take care of that for you, right? So hardware, essentially, those operations have been outsourced. But then you can move up the stack and say, like, well, there's actually going to be a dedicated team of people who manage the kernel and the operating system, right? And people like CoreOS, if you've taken a look at CoreOS or Red Hat Atomic or some of the work that Ubuntu is doing with Snappy, they're really trying to make this OS that is manageable as an independent entity, right? CoreOS says, essentially, the OS is independent from the applications. Applications all run in containers. The OS itself is this sort of almost self-managing thing. They're using the Chrome OS A/B updating approach to be able to very reliably update that operating system for you, in fact, if you want to run that way. And then you look at Kubernetes, and Kubernetes is really trying to provide this clustering layer where you can have a team that is dedicated to providing your clustering infrastructure. And that infrastructure presents a new API that's not it's not an x86 as a service API, it's a higher level API. And then in turn, applications SRE, can manage the applications that they're building on top of this cluster management layer. And in each of these places, you've decoupled one from the other. And in fact, when I was essentially doing applications SRE for search infrastructure, I rarely talked to the people who are doing cluster SRE. I used their API, and I expected their API to work. And it pretty much did, right? Because they were doing their jobs, and they were keeping their API running. Just like, you know, when you use a cloud API, I think there's a lot of value in getting areas. I see the AV guy coming down.
What am I calling? I'm trying to switch.
Can everybody hear me?
No.
Dang. All right. It's on. Oh, now I can hear myself. I should have known that, actually. Oh, well. Do I have to start again? No. All right. Well, I could have been louder, too. I can do that, too. My flow is totally messed up now. Application SRE, kernel SRE. And the basic idea there is that you can develop areas of expertise where you really know what you're doing and you're decoupled from all the other dependencies and you're free to operate, right? We can roll kernels across the entire fleet without notifying application owners that we're going to roll kernels across the entire fleet. This enables homogeneity, it enables maintainability, it enables us to have one operating system. You don't have to worry about, like, this team wants Fedora and this team wants Red Hat, and, you know, heaven forbid that somebody wants to upgrade the library that both MySQL and Python depend on or whatever it happens to be. Like, these problems all just go away, right? And so the team is more flexibly available, and it's also has a system that is inherently more manageable. All right, that's enough time on that slide. All right, so Kubernetes basically is providing, to sort of zoom in on this, Kubernetes is providing this unified compute substrate that basically takes a whole bunch of machines, because there has to be a machine somewhere, and they're either virtual or physical, depending on essentially whether your company started before or after about 2008. And it turns it into this abstract layer where basically you can just say, I want cores, right? When I launch an application, I don't think about machines. I think about cores and memory and disk, right? The raw kind of resources that my program needs, but not the, like, actual infrastructure. And very rarely do I think about the actual infrastructure that it's running on. I think about it at this abstract logical layer, not the sort of inherent physical layer. And so as an application developer and as an application manager, I really just think about deploying the processes and the amount of resources that the processes need. And I trust that this compute substrate, this unified compute substrate that has abstracted my data center into this generic API, can take care of figuring out where the appropriate set of resources are available and placing things there. And that's really what Kubernetes is about. All right, so I want to talk briefly about the architecture of Kubernetes. And this should look pretty familiar to a lot of people. Anyone who has sort of read the Borg paper or looked at similar architecture this architecture has been created in a number of different places at this point. When I was looking into open sourcing Kubernetes, there was a lot of feedback about, like, isn't this the Google secret sauce and dot, 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 dot. And I was sort of like, well, you know what? We've had a lot of engineers. Some of them have left. We don't have, like, the men in black little flashy thing yet, right? Like, this is not a secret anymore that this is how we build software. So Kubernetes basically has a set of master components that provide the API and things like scheduling and online control, and we'll talk a little bit more about what that means. And then it manages an arbitrary series of nodes that provide the raw resources that are available as that compute infrastructure. And it has the kubelet that runs on each of those, the service proxy that we'll talk about in a little bit that provides some networking infrastructure for connecting containers together. All of this is backed up into etcd, which is, I like to describe it as open source Chubby. So if you've read the Chubby paper, it's an open source implementation of Chubby. It's by CoreOS, a very nice piece of software that we like to use. Provides some really nice functionality. I'm not going to go into the details of why it is the right choice for this infrastructure, but if you're interested, I can talk to you about it later. And then the API provides a RESTful API. We provide a command line tool, web interfaces if you want to build a web GUI, APIs in various languages. We generate a Swagger spec, so you can actually do client generation in whatever language you happen to want to use. And so that's the basics of how you interact with the system. Now I want to talk a little bit about the objects that are available and how this sort of relates to operations. So the basic idea behind Kubernetes is that the atomic unit of what you schedule is called a pod. And a pod is basically a collection of multiple, one or more containers that run together that share a bunch of things. They share file systems, optionally. They can have their own file systems, but they can share file systems as well. They share all of the network namespaces and the IPC namespaces, and basically every namespace in the kernel that Docker will allow us to manipulate, we share across the pod. And then finally, they share a series of key value pairs that we call labels. And labels are really used as the organizational primitives for organizing all of the infrastructure that is inside of your cluster. It turns out that one of the lessons that we've learned over time is that having ways to flexibly group things and dynamically group things based on queries rather than based on sort of object hierarchies is the right thing to do. We have, in previous incarnations of systems, built things where there were very strict hierarchies of, like, this is a job, and a job has a bunch of replicated tasks, and it owns those tasks. And in an example I'll show you later on, you'll see how labels are actually a strictly more powerful way of expressing this concept and have flexibility that actually enables some use cases that we simply cannot do if you have fixed hierarchical constructs that are baked into your system. All right, so now I'm stealing all my thunder and my slides. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about what a pod is, because when I start talking about running multiple containers, one of the first things that people sometimes say is like, ah, multiple containers, I understand what this is. It's WordPress and MySQL, and I put those things together. And while that's perfectly possible, and you can do that, it's actually not a very good example of a pod, because that's not an atomic unit, right? You don't want to scale your database in the same way that you scale your WordPress front ends. You don't want to, in fact, you probably, initially, you don't want to scale your database at all, right? Eventually, you're going to get to the place where you want to learn about replication and you need to do the reliable things. But as a sort of foray into it, the very first thing you do is like, oh, my PHP servers need more PHP servers, and I'll separate the database out. And so it's not a good example. A better example is something like Git synchronization, right? Where I want to run a Git synchronizer that its sole responsibility is basically to watch a specific tag and pull down that tag. Every time it gets updated, pull it down onto the file system. Right? And on the other side, I put a web server like Nginx or anything else like that. And like, hey, in this modular way, I've just built Git push to deploy. Right? And each of these pieces is its own little, so we're talking about decoupling. Again, this idea of having a pod with multiple containers in it, it's decoupled application functionality. Nginx sticks to its business of like serving stuff off the file system. The Git synchronizer sticks to its business of synchronizing things to the file system. And because they have these separation of concerns, different teams can own these pieces. You can test them in different ways. And indeed, you can actually reuse them. And so if you don't like Nginx and you want to use Node.js, you can use the same Git synchronizer, right? So just like objects in programming languages allow us to reuse code and allow different teams to share code, multiple containers inside your pod allow you to separate out the functionality and actually reuse that functionality in different ways. And I think this is really going to be an evolution in the way that we build distributed systems. Modular components, maybe even not built by you, that we can reuse. So that's sort of the part of the motivation behind a pod. It's also the case that these things don't make sense when you run them across multiple machines, and so that's why the pod is the atomic unit of scheduling. These things have to be placed on the same machine in order for it to make sense. All right, I wanted to also add a little bit of a shout out to one of the talks yesterday and talk about how I think that the Prometheus exporters that they've built are a great example of why you might want to run a pod, right? You may have some web application that you don't control, you don't have the source code for, that's exporting statsd, but you really want to use Prometheus, right? Because you've decided that that's the monitoring infrastructure that you're happy with, or maybe you're instrumenting your new binaries with Prometheus, but your old binaries had statsd and you want to have a unified monitoring framework. You can, in a single pod, deploy your web application and the statsd bridge that they provide, and because they're sharing the same namespace, they can see each other on localhost. That means they use the loopback device for communication. It means that there's no discovery or naming or anything you have to worry about. You just point your web app at localhost, and it all just sort of works out. And so this is another example of how this modular component works with no matter what thing that exports statsd, or you can swap in whatever the other Prometheus bridges that they have for various daemon, Redis and everything else that they have, JMX and everything else that they have. So this is another great example, I think, of why you want to be able to take multiple different containers built by different people, potentially even combine them together into this single atomic unit that's going to get scheduled out into your system. All right, want to spend a little bit of time on labels. Basic idea behind labels is they're key value pairs, and they're going to basically describe your job. Now that's sort of okay, but the real power comes in when you start querying across these things. And so for an example, we might say, like, I want the stage to be production. So that selects out these three jobs. See, out of the four jobs that I have running, it selects out these three things, the four pods that I have running. It selects out these three pods where the stage is production in each case. Now I can do conjunctions as well, and I can say things like, I want the stage to be production and the role to be back end. Right? And so I have this sea of objects that's out there. There is no hierarchy in Kubernetes. And I can issue these label queries out into the system in order to group things together in order to service different kinds of things. Maybe I want to see everything that's running on a machine because I can see that my task on this machine is behaving badly, and I suspect that maybe it's because there's poor isolation and I have a noisy neighbor. I just say, like, I want to see everything in the system where machine is the specific machine. Maybe I want to see everything that I've created because, you know, I've gotten an email that I'm over quota and I need to turn down something. So I can say, show me everything that I've created. Or I can say, show me everything that's not production that I've created. Show me everything that is in batch priority that I've created. These become ways that you can essentially slice across in the same way that labels are used to slice across monitoring data. You can slice across your actual running infrastructure. And at the same time, these labels get populated into your monitoring data. So you can slice across your monitoring data with the exact same sort of set of keys and values, and that's pretty powerful. And it really forms the basis for the next two API objects that I wanted to talk about. So before I talk about that, I want to talk about briefly about the idea of reconciliation. Probably is not a foreign concept to most people, but the basic idea is that rather than simply having a set of deployment scripts that you execute in order to achieve the state of being deployed, a true system like Kubernetes is really an online system. It's much more akin to the thing that is keeping the temperature of this room at a nice even temperature than it is to a series of instructions, right? You don't go and say like, oh, I heated up the room to 72 degrees, we're good here. Like, we'll walk away and never do anything. No, you're constantly saying, what's the desired state? I want the world to be, you know, I want this room to be 72 degrees. What's the current state? Ah, it's currently 69, I better turn up the heat. Ah, it's currently 73, I better turn the heat down, turn on the air conditioning a little bit. Right, so Kubernetes has a bunch of primitives that are these online reconciled primitives where they're constantly measuring the desired state of the world, the current state of the world, and taking action to make desired state match up with current state. And again, this is in some ways like what the Facebook guys were talking about in terms of you want robots to do this stuff, right? If I want there to be three things in the world, I don't want to be paged to be asked to create it just because something happened to have died, right? I want the system that knows there's supposed to be three things to take action on my behalf and create that thing that's missing. And so that leads into the first Kubernetes concept, which is the idea of a replication controller. So a replication controller is really the notion that in most systems, each layer is really a bunch of copies of the same homogeneous piece of software, right? And so a replication controller becomes a template, the sort of cookie cutter that you use to cut out the software that you're interested in, a set of labels that are the query across the world to see if I have the expected number that I want, and the number of things that I want. And so at each sort of iteration through this reconciliation cycle, I take a look out into the world, I see how many things are out there that match my label query, I difference that with my expected number, maybe I wanted there to be three and I only see two, I go and I create one. Maybe I wanted there to be two and I see that there are three, I go and destroy one. Maybe I see that there's two and I wanted there to be two and I'm just happy, right? And that's the idea of a replication controller. It's this online system that can take care of scaling up, it can take care of scaling down, it can take care of health check failures, and basically provide the ability to make a declarative statement about the way you want the world to be and trust that the system is going to keep yourself there. Now the other aspect of Kubernetes is the idea of a service. And a service is basically combining together service discovery with automated maintenance of the back-end set, right? So instead of maintaining health, the controller that's running inside of Kubernetes is actually maintaining the set of jobs that should be implementing this particular service. So when I have, say, a front-end and I need it to talk to a back-end, I don't want to have to reprogram the front-end to know where all of the back-ends are every time I scale back-ends up and down or if something dies because of a health check, anything else like that. I want there to be a concept because, frankly, the front-ends don't really care. They just know they need to talk to the back end, in quotes, right? And so services provide the ability to essentially to have a fixed IP address that is the concept that is independent. It's been decoupled from the actual implementation of that concept. That means I can use DNS because the concept and the IP address are bound together and their lifespan is the same, and I don't have to worry about the fact that the Java client caches DNS for forever and you know, no matter what you set the TTL to, right? I can actually trust that IP address stays the same because it's really just a concept. It's not an actual running process. And I can trust the service infrastructure to maintain the label query across all of the different things that are running out in the world and program the load balancer so that it actually takes the packets that are sent to the conceptual address and maps them to an actual address where there's an actual process running that can actually handle the traffic. Right? And this loop, again, it runs continuously where I take this name, which is associated with the DNS name that is associated with the IP, I issue the label query, I find all the things that match the label query, and I place them into the load balancing set for the service. And also, obviously, I declare the ports that I want to load balance across as well. All right, so I wanted to give an example of how labels really enable you to do powerful things in operations that you can't otherwise do with hierarchical operations. And so the example of this is you may have a replication controller that's running up here that's responsible for maintaining three running applications, right? Pretty standard stuff. So what happens in the middle of the night when one of these things goes sick? Right? This particular front end is sick. We've monitored it. We've indicated bad things are happening. It's throwing 500s or whatever it happens to be. We want to take it out of service. Well, traditionally, what you would do is you take it out back, you'd shoot it in the head, and it would be replaced. Right? Now, I, as a developer, am crying inside. Not because you've shot my program, I don't really care about my program, but because what you've left me with is a bunch of logs, right? And to be honest, I probably didn't put the right logging information in the first place. So what's going to happen is you're going to say, hey, I mean, if it happens enough, it happens once, you probably don't tell me. But if it happens 10 times, you're going to come to me and you're going to say, like, I think there's a bug here. Here's all the log files. Could you figure it out? And what I'm going to do is I'm going to look through all those log files and I'm going to realize where I should have put the logging statements. And I'm going to go in and I'm going to instrument my code with the logging statements that I should have had. We're going to deploy a new release eventually. And then we're going to hope that the problem happens again. Right? And that's not a good world, right? So, but the way we can work around this with labels is actually when this happens and this job is sick, I can actually just remove that production label. So let's think about what happens when I remove that production label. Well, my load balancer was defined as being front-end in production. So this job leaves my load balancing set. My replication controller was defined as saying, I want three things that match front-end in production. So suddenly it wakes up and notices there's only two things that match front-end in production. And so that pod exits both the load balancing set and the replicated set. These sets can be disjoint, by the way. They don't have to be the same set, although they are in this example. And leaves this void. And the replication controller notices this void and steps in and creates a new front end. And so I'm back to serving at the right capacity. I have the three jobs that I want to have running. But I, as a developer, when you tell me that this bad thing happened, you give me a running server. Right? And I can poke at that running server, and I can do all sorts. I can SSH into that machine if I have to. I don't want to, but if I have to. But I can poke at that server. I can look at all of its monitoring variables. I can look at, you know, I can sort of try and send it requests and see what happened. I can potentially even attach a debugger, although that rarely works. But the point is that, and then I get to take it out back and shoot it. Right, and that's the value of this flexibility, is that no longer is the notion of what I'm balancing tied to the actual, it doesn't own the things that it balances across of, and so it's very easy to remove things from that set. Same thing with replication. So this is a really powerful, flexible concept. To illustrate this a little bit further, I wanted to also show how you can use this in a live demo setting, because everybody loves a little blood. I wanted to show you how you can use labels to do a rolling update. So I'm going to drop out of here and drop into my terminal and hope that everything, all right, no, that's the wrong terminal. That's the right terminal. All right. Yikes, I might have to put that down. That's a big noise. You can't see my terminal right now. No, it's true, you can't. But you will in just a moment. I wanted to show you just what I have running here. This is a very, very simplified application for this particular example. I have a service up in the upper left, which is just, you know, my awesome app. It's showing my awesome app. So there's the virtual IP address that's associated with that address. It's currently balancing across those three sets. I have a replication controller here that's responsible for maintaining the fact that there are three running examples right here. So, and those are the actual containers, the actual pods that are running the code itself. And so if we take a look, you know, this is my awesome application version 1.0, right? So I'm gonna move this out. It is an awesome application, but you should see awesome application 2.0. It has even more awesome, right? And so I'm gonna go over here, and I'm actually gonna say here I want to do, and you get to see that I tried this before the talk to make sure it actually worked. All right, so I want to do a rollout, and I'm gonna roll out my app. And I want the image to change from being V1 to being V2. All right. And so Kubernetes behind the scenes is actually going to create a second replication controller. So we go over here. We'll see it's creating a second replication controller. And that replication controller is creating things that are my app V2. Now what you can see here is though the replication controllers are controlling different sets of things, the service is balancing across all of them. That's what I get out of the services set being disjoint from the replication controller's set. So we can go over here and we can actually take a look at this app. We can say, all right. Oh, wait. It only has more cowbell. I was hoping for more awesome. This is what happens when you haven't slept in a while. So let's go over and we'll cancel this rolling update. And now, actually, I'm going to say, okay, that was sort of embarrassing, but now let's roll it back. And so a rollout is actually just a rollback. A rollout is just a rollback in reverse, or a rollback is just a rollout in reverse. And we'll go back over here, and now it's actually going to take that, and it vanished, and the replication controller goes away. Will happen in a moment. And now we're back to steady state. So I realized my mistake. Now let's actually roll forward again, go and we'll roll out to V3. So we'll roll out to V3 and we'll take this. Same thing is happening. It's created a new replication controller, started rolling out my app V3. Take a look at that. Oh, see, now V3 had more awesome, and that was what we were looking for. And now, actually, I can wait. You can wait, and by default, when you do a rolling update, it takes a 3-minute inter-arrival in between each. You know, it's going to turn this one up, and then it's going to turn one down, and turn one up, and turn one down, and you'll have, you know, right now you have 3 V1s and 1 V3. Soon you'll have 2 V3s and 2 V1s, and then you're going to have 3 V3s and 1 V1, and then you're just going to have 3 V3s. It's a little bit boring if we wait 3 minutes in between each one, and so let's kill this and actually say update period. It's easier when I have two hands. All right, so don't ever do this for reals because 2 seconds is way, way, way too fast. But it's going to see that actually there was an update already in progress, and it's actually going to take charge of that update, and it's going to start moving things much more quickly. And so you can actually see now we have 2 V3s, 3 V1s. It's going to next kill one of your V1s, do the process of turning one dial up, turning one dial down, turning one dial up, turning one dial down. Maybe even 2 seconds is still boring. And eventually what's going to happen is you're going to be left with 3 V3s, and it's going to rename that MyApp replication controller from being, you know, MyApp dash big ol' hash that's there to differentiate between things to being MyApp. And I've essentially rolled out from V1 to V3, and I'm back to sort of steady state, but the version has obviously changed. And again, if I at this point still don't like what's going on, I can again do a rollback, and it will roll back everything to the V1 state that it was before. All right, so and again, this is all just using label manipulation, replication controllers, and services to make sure that I have balancing across both my old app and my new app, so I get a degree of canarying, as well as the ability to sort of turn the dial down on one and turn the dial up on the other simultaneously as we do this rolling update. All right, and so I have about 5 minutes left, and so I wanted to talk very briefly about the last piece of decoupling I'll present here. Because I've had some conversations with people while I'm here, and so this is the, like, I put these into my talk at 11 p.m. last night, so, you know, it was, I'm sure it was a good idea. But this is where I wanted to take a step forward and actually point and say, like, this is something we don't do right now, but this is, I think, something where we're going. And the last piece of, so if you think about containers as having sort of decoupled operating systems from processes, and you think about containers as having made compute be application-oriented, I think we need to do the same thing with the network. Right? So the network right now looks something like this. There are machines, and they talk to each other, and packets travel through these machines, and there's routing. And because there's routing through machines that you don't control in the little squishy cloud in the middle, you need things like encryption, and you need things like identity, because people can spoof IP addresses, and et cetera, et cetera. These are all problems that the application owner has to solve. And frankly, just like you don't want me rolling kernels, you probably don't want me doing certificate management either, right? But I have to. So we give containers their own IP addresses. That's a really powerful thing. But still, the networking still kind of looks the same, right? And so, but what we're starting to look at doing is essentially laying our SDN on top, container to container with direct links, and making all of the routing stuff just go away, right? That becomes the problem of the SDN, not the problem of me as an application owner. And I actually can basically get an API, just like I have an API that allows me to create VMs. In most cloud networks, I actually have the ability to create point-to-point links, well, at least in the Compute Engine cloud network, you have the ability to create point-to-point links between specific IP addresses. And so I can actually just say, like, connect IP, you know, I should say IP1 and IP2, but that's because it was 11 p.m. last night. Connect IP1 to IP2 with a certain QoS. Now, we don't have the QoS part in Compute Engine right now because there aren't different QoS classes, but you can see how this produces a much, much simpler network from an application developer's perspective. And more importantly, what it enables me to do is because the SDN is laying in these point-to-point connections for me and providing encryption in the transport in the SDN rather than in the actual things that are going between the applications, I don't have to worry really about encryption or identity or authorization. The SDN and the API layer takes care of that for me. If these two things can talk to each other, because again, we're elevating things to the application level, if these two applications can talk to each other, it's because somebody said they should be able to talk to each other, right? And if they shouldn't be able to talk to each other, they literally can't, right? And you can have centralized auditing, compliance, and enforcement because, again, all of this stuff is being lifted into the SDN layer and no certificate distribution in your applications because, again, things like encryption are happening outside of the purview of the application. So I think this is a really exciting area. I don't think anybody's doing this right now. I think it's a really exciting area to move forward into, and I'm sort of putting it out there because I'm hopeful that somebody will come along and help us get there. So that's about it. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Where's the microphone?
Let's see it.
Talk here. Okay. So if you change the rule specification where you previously said you wanted three production VMs and say, or three, I'm sorry, three production instances, and you say, okay, well, now I want six. How quickly does that get updated into the rule set and then additional instances spun up?
Order of seconds.
Sweet. Okay.
So, I mean, the thing that gates it almost always is the image pull. So if your image is present on the machines that you want to run, then it's order of seconds. If not, then it's order of however long it takes for your container image to download to that machine.
Cool. Okay.
So.
Nice.
Yeah. That's one of the nice things about containers as processes rather than VMs.
Ouch. Okay, so the example you showed was of a stateless application, and
sure.
I can see how for stateless applications it's pretty sweet to run this on Kubernetes, but how is it running stuff like databases on Kubernetes? Their behavior is quite different, and they don't tolerate failure so nicely and you know being poked around.
Right, so I think it really depends. You know, a system like Cassandra works really, really well. Like, it's built for this kind of environment. And you don't need to do anything fancy with Cassandra to make it work. It can use transient state, and it doesn't really care. A system like MySQL or any other sort of traditional database really expects its storage to be a pet, right? It expects the storage to be taken care of, and when it gets sick, get better, and things like that. And in that context, what you have to do is you have to isolate the compute from the storage. And so we provide a lot of functionality that enables you to use network-attached storage, either in the form of, you know, cloud APIs like Google Persistent Disk or EBS or anything else like that, or, you know, iSCSI or whatever your favorite, you know, network-attached storage is. Or even, Cluster HQ, which is a startup, showed how you can use ZFS and their software to actually do this with files on your local disk, but still distributing the files around. And the basic idea is you're going to decouple the thing that's running from the storage that it needs. And the storage is going to move to wherever the compute happens to land. Right? And that's how you can achieve running MySQL or anything else like that in this environment, where your compute might move and you need the data to move along with it.
Locality?
Sorry?
What if I need locality?
If you need locality, like on a specific machine?
Yeah, or matching, you know, software with the data, for example, the storage.
I think that you. I would argue that in the limit, our experience shows that's not going to work out for you, because the minute you run four, five, six different jobs that all need locality, you've basically deadlocked your scheduler, right? Like you can't satisfy all the constraints at the same time. You may as well make your network attached storage really, really fast, and powerful, because you're going to hit that point eventually anyway, where you know three of the MapReduces are going to be great and the fourth really sucks, right? So, because this is all about sharing the resources across a variety of different jobs. So,
okay, we're out of time.
Yeah, sorry, I'll be around. And also, we're on GitHub and IRC, so please come hang out with us. Thanks.